Knock, knock. Who's there? Brian Laundry gets a visit from Florida police in the disappearance of his fiancée, Gabby Petito. Just one problem. He wasn't in the house. And now his attorney says Brian Laundry is missing too. Also tonight, you know things are serious when even the lawyers are in trouble. There's a lot of missing insurance money in the Murdoch saga. And at least one lawyer with a whole lot of questions he wants answered. And it's live PD night, policing in America, as seen through the body cams of the men and women in uniform. Welcome to Banfield. Tonight, major developments in the search for Gabby Petito. Plenty of action outside and inside the home of her fiancé, Brian Laundry's parents. Authorities have spent more than 4 hours inside that home, from daylight to darkness, while outside the house, demonstrators with bullhorns have been calling for Brian's head. But they're going to have to find him first, because right now, even his own lawyer says his whereabouts are unknown. Here was the statement that he handed the press just in the last hour. Be advised that the whereabouts of Brian Laundry are currently unknown. The FBI is currently at the Laundry residence, removing property to assist in locating Brian. As of now, the FBI is looking for both Gabby and Brian. Just a short distance away, these are the images. This was not at the home, but just away from the Laundry home, a candlelight vigil being held for Gabby. It's outside of the Northport, Florida City Hall. Gabby Petito, you'll probably know, went missing while driving cross-country in that now famous white van with her fiancé, Brian Laundry. Since then, he has lawyered up and refused to cooperate with the police. He's refused to speak privately or publicly, it seems. Yesterday, his sister Cassie, however, Cassie Laundry, broke her silence, speaking to ABC News. We've got more of that interview for you now, including the shocking revelation that even Cassie says she's been unable to speak with her brother, Brian.
Me and my family want Gabby to be found safe. She's like a sister, and my children love her. And all I want is for her to come home safe and sound, and this to be just a big misunderstanding. I haven't been able to talk to him. I wish I could talk to him. And I've cooperated every way that I can. I wish I had information, or I would give more. This is all I have, is I gave to the police.
Well, that lack of communication from the Laundries, even within their own family members, has certainly frustrated Gabby's father.
What do you think of Brian?
I don't. Right now, I do. And I also think of his parents, but anything that I say here is not going to help me out there, you know. So that'll be later on. I'll let the courts and, you know, society judge them. I've already did my judgment. It's not going to change. And if you realize you're a family member, aunt, uncle, cousin, whatever you are to them, and you associate with the Laundries, you know, if you work with the banks with them, if you know they try and buy a car from you, you try and rent a book from you, you should say no, thank you. You can turn them away.
Joe Petito's frustrations, as are obvious there, they're shared by people right across the country. And also right there in Northport, and that's where I want to bring in News Nation's Brian Enten, who's been on stakeout out in front of the Laundry's house for days now. And a whole lot of people have joined you in the last day or so, Brian, with bullhorns, and they are angry. Set the scene for me.
Yeah, it was wild tonight. About 5-6 o'clock, I would say about 50 people showed up with bullhorns. They started shouting, "We want to know where Gabby is. Come out, Brian. Come out, Brian." And they were relentless. They didn't stop for, you know, an hour or so. And then it was so interesting. You mentioned it. Out of nowhere, a black van pulls up. Two FBI agents get out. They go into the house. A short time later, another police car shows up. Two more detectives go into the house. We weren't sure what to expect. We didn't know if they were going to bring Brian Laundry out. We didn't know what was going to happen. About 3 hours go by. They bring evidence in and out. They search a car. 3 hours go by, they leave, and then, bombshell, we find out that Brian Laundrie is now missing.
So, Brian, this is what I want to figure out here. I can see them going in and out of those doors. I don't see a warrant. I don't know if anybody saw a warrant. Were the police invited in, allowed in, or did they have to bring that formal piece of paper to say, open up?
No, it is our understanding that Brian Laundrie's parents called the police and requested that they come here because they wanted to talk about Brian Laundrie. That is what we heard earlier today. Now, putting the pieces together, they wanted to talk to the police because their son is now missing.
So the other question, when you were doing your live reporting just moments ago, we saw some of the officers come out and ruffle through the back of a van, and then they just walked back into the house with some very small evidence. It looked like evidence bags, not the kind that I would have expected. I would have expected big, huge bags. Do we know if they came out with those bags full, bulging, anything that might have looked like, I don't know, cell phones or laptops or anything like that?
So they weren't bulging, and they were small paper bags, almost like what you would get at the grocery store. And they came out with two of them, and they weren't bulging at all. You'd almost think there was paper inside, maybe a cell phone, but nothing. I mean, we were out on the street. They were keeping us back. Nothing that you could see bulging or anything like that. So it wasn't like a large item.
So I always wonder about line of sight. When you're on stakeout, as you have been, I know there's a lot of fast food in your car because you've been there for days. Did you ever see Brian Laundrie actually in that house or go into that house? And obviously, you didn't see him come out. So let's start with the, did you see him go in?
We have never seen Brian Laundrie at this house, and we've been here for about 4 days, almost around the clock. What's interesting, we were on your show last night. We finished up. We were getting some more videos, sort of just keeping an eye on the house again late into the night. And my photographer and I were talking, and we came to the conclusion there is no one in this house. There is no one that's been here for the day. It was pitch black last night. It's a small house. There was no light even coming out of any of the windows. I'm like, somehow this family is gone. So I was frankly shocked today when the FBI showed up at the door, and I thought no one's going to answer the door. And then the door just sort of cracked open, and the first thing I said is like, oh my gosh, there's someone. There's been someone in the house. So we don't know if the parents and Brian have been here for days, and maybe Brian snuck out a back door or a back window and no one saw, or if Brian has just been in another location and the parents realized that he's now missing.
And I'm just trying to orient myself behind you there. There's a pickup truck behind you. Does that belong to the Laundries? Is that their driveway?
Yeah, let's walk around, Luis. Just bear with me because there's a lot of reporters out here, so it might not be the prettiest shot, but it'll give you a better orientation here. This is the laundry house right here. And you see the pickup truck, you see the camper, there's a police car in front, police officer, and then you see that silver Mustang. That's interesting because after they took out the two brown paper bag evidence bags, then the police went to that Mustang, opened the side door, took something out of the Mustang, and then opened the trunk and took something out. So apparently the Mustang is also significant in some way, Ashley.
And so the officer that I saw behind you that's standing near the Mustang, is he effectively on crowd control because of the protesters, the media? I saw a whole lot of people all over their lawn as well, which is property. Are they basically staking out and staying there to keep people from doing anything else?
It seems like that's the case. It's really quieted down out here tonight. There's maybe like a dozen people compared to when the streets were packed earlier. But yeah, it seems like the police are just sort of out here keeping an eye on things. And some of the neighbors have wondered, I mean, if Brian Laundrie is missing, is it possible that he could show back up here? I mean, is that why? It's not just that officer. There's other officers on the block, all stationed. I mean, is that a possibility? Could he show back up out here?
Well, yeah, when you're looking for someone, that's usually how officers do it. They find the people closest to them and they monitor them nice and tight. Can you do me a favor and just orient me to the tour you were taking us on down the other way? Like, there seemed to be a lot of press, and I just wanted to get a feel for, I don't know, the frenzy that it seems to be. This story just seems to be captivating
yes. So
the nation.
Let's back up 1 second, Luis. Let's wait for this van to go by, because it's a rural area. I mean, it's dark out here. This is not like inside a city at all. So we'll back up and we'll kind of give you the shot here. You see there's about a dozen people out here now. Again, the street was full earlier because people thought Brian Laundry was inside, and that's when they were chanting. You've got the laundry house right here. And then if you look in this direction down the street, you've got more media. And then walk over here with me really quickly. I want to show you this because this is sort of relevant. And again, it's so dark, but if you look down the side of the house, it's a small house. And you can see there's sort of lights on in the background there. There are other homes behind this house and then a street. And some of the neighbors have suspected that if Brian Laundry wanted to get out and avoid all of the media, he could have gone out a side window or out a back door, just gone through an empty lot back there, and then ended up on another street where there's not nearly as many people.
You know, that was going to be my next question. I'm glad you took us on that tour, because I wondered if it would be easy just to get out the back door and up over a neighbor's fence and back through the blackness to avoid the prying eyes of all the public and the press who are dying to find out where this man is. So another question for you, and that is about the FBI. I saw the Northport police there, and you're saying the FBI is in there as well. I'm assuming they're working together, but is this a serious effort to find a missing man, or is this a serious effort to find a potential fugitive?
That's a good question. They're not telling us that. I mean, they keep, like, Brian, I was thinking about this earlier. Brian Laundry, attorney, is saying that he's missing. Is he technically on the run now? Is that why the FBI is now involved? And you see all these police all over the place, and it's suddenly become a big circus out here. We don't know the answer to that question.
Okay, I have one last question for you, and I don't propose to think you might know the answer to this, because I know you've been on stakeout, but it's the other side of this story, and that is Gabby. Gabby is still missing, and we don't know where. We presume somewhere out west. And a lot of people, Brian, have been pointing out that her Instagram was very different before she went missing. It was as though her posts were all very short, you know, like before she went missing, she had a style. And it seemed to change after she went missing. Her posts went from being, you know, nice and short, concise, to being really long, focusing on environmentalism. And here's the clincher, talking about Brian and tagging Brian all the time. I know that there is some suspicion that some messages that have gone to the family, maybe at least one, wasn't her. Is there some suspicion by police that these posts after she went missing are not at all Gabby's posts, but perhaps maybe Brian?
First of all, it started to rain out here, so forgive me if we look a little wet. But interesting, today the police said they do not have Gabby Petito's cell phone. They don't have it. We have heard from friends that Brian Laundry never had a cell phone and that he would use Gabby's. So it's very possible that Brian was using Gabby's cell phone in the couple of weeks that she was unaccounted for, but there were still posts on her Instagram and texts going to her mother. It's possible it was him or someone else, because you've heard the mom say some of the texts didn't seem like Gabby.
Yeah, and I hate to do this to you because I know you're getting rained on, but there's so much that I still want to know. So if you could just indulge me for a minute. I'm sorry to do this to you, Brian. There was another piece of information that came out today about a place called Jenny Lake in Grand Teton National Park, and that the police are actually focusing on Jenny Lake. Do you know anything more about that, whether they really are zeroing in on at least a search site at this time?
From what we understand, they are searching, but there is not a specific area. I was looking at some maps of a helicopter and two airplanes in the area that were doing a search grid today in Wyoming. So they are definitely searching. Gabby's stepdad is out there with family members. There is an ongoing search out there. But from my understanding, it's not like a pinpointed area at this point.
And then another thing to clear up, because yesterday we talked about the newlyweds who were killed not far in Moab from where Brian and Gabby had a run-in, a domestic incident. They're now ruling that those two things are not connected, which I find shocking since they don't seem to have any answers on who killed these two people on the screen. But they say they're not related. But do they tell us why they think that? Do we have any idea why they're now saying don't get distracted by the murders of those two women, even though they're at the exact same location, really within the week of each other, they're unrelated?
No, they did not give details, but their statement, it wasn't wishy-washy. The sheriff put out a statement there saying that we've investigated and the cases are not related. So something that they've done behind the scenes, they've determined that. But yes, it is interesting because they were right in that same location.
Okay, I've done enough to you tonight. My goodness, you've taken me on a tour. Yes. You've done all this reporting and then you've just been hammered by the rain. So I apologize and I thank you profusely for your reporting tonight, Brian. You are getting a gift after this one. Thank you, sir.
See you, Ashley.
That is intrepid right there. Brian is amazing. We're going to continue on this. And there are so many questions still to be answered in this bizarre twist with now Brian Laundrie. It's all about him now. He's missing too. All right, I'm going to switch gears to the Murdoch story because, holy Moses, last night, the lawyer for the kids of the housekeeper who died mysteriously in the Murdoch's home, he just, you know, let it slide here that it's about $4 million that they were due that they did not get and that money is out there somewhere. So we're going to talk to that lawyer again because guess what? He has even more to tell us tonight. Eric Bland is next. Welcome back. There is sometimes a pretty big difference between how the legal system is supposed to work and how it actually works. And you probably did not need me to tell you that. In 2018, the longtime housekeeper for the Murdoch family of South Carolina, she died after a trip and fall, the details of which are still pretty murky, but not as murky as the legal proceedings that followed that accident. The sons of Gloria Satterfield, that housekeeper, well, they moved to sue Alex Murdoch, who just had quite a week, as you probably know, supposedly at Murdoch's behest. Weirdly, think about that. They sued him because he asked them to. And then he asked them to use a lawyer that he would supply for them. Oh, that's awfully nice. Quote, Alex Murdoch told those kids, Tony and Brian, told their uncle and aunt, that he was going to take care of the boys because he was going to sue myself for the death of Gloria Satterfield. That's from a lawsuit that was filed this week by the family's brand new lawyer, who points out that the old lawyer, unbeknownst to Tony and Brian, he was a former college roommate of Alex Murdoch and Alex Murdoch's best friend and the godfather of Alex Murdoch's son, Paul Murdoch. That's just nuts. The lawyer's name is Corey Fleming. And there's also a name for that kind of arrangement that I just described. A lot of people call it conflict of interest. But since that's a legal term, I'm going to say allegedly. But if it's true, it's really big. For Gloria Satterfield's family, it was also very expensive because a few months later, Alex Murdoch's insurance companies agreed to pay out. Yep, we got you covered. We're going to pay for that trip and fall, Gloria Satterfield. We're going to pay at least $500,000. But as it turns out, it seems it may have been much more. And when I say much more, like a hell of a lot more, like $4 million. And the family, well, that should have been great. That should have helped those boys, right? Now that they don't have their mom. They haven't seen a penny. So tonight, with the ink barely dry on their lawsuit, the family's brand new lawyer, Eric Bland, is asking the South Carolina bar to sanction that old lawyer, Alex Murdoch's BFF, Corey Fleming. And it just so happens that Eric Bland is live with me now from Columbia. Welcome back to the program, Eric. Did I get anything wrong in that characterization of how the last 3 years went?
Barry, you're spot on. The only thing is I'm not asking the bar to sanction him. I just merely perform my duty to inform the bar as a lawyer of our state when I know that somebody else has possibly violated the rules of professional conduct. I'm duty bound to inform the bar and then the bar does their own investigation. So I supplied them with a copy of the complaint and presumably they will start an investigation.
So what does that mean for Corey Fleming? Because, you know, the layperson in me says that's just icky. Maybe he should lose his license. But is there something more sinister? Is there something criminal to that?
I'm not going to venture into the criminal, but there is something that could jeopardize his license if the bar was to find that he had misappropriated money or assisted others in misappropriating money from clients or secreting material information from the clients in order to enrich others instead of his duty of fidelity to the clients. He could have his license impacted either through suspension or ultimately he could lose his license. You know, two things we were told in law school: never lie to your client, never steal money from your client. If you do, you're going to lose your ticket.
But we out here outside law school, we're told you're going to go to jail if you steal money from people. So that's why I asked. This sounds like he could be exposed also to the criminal procedures.
You know, like Al Capone went to jail for income tax evasion. He didn't go to jail for, you know, all the killings that he did. I believe that this case is at the epicenter of what's going to happen ultimately in Hampton County to the Murdochs and a lot of different people because of the amount of money that has not been accounted for and misappropriated. I think that ultimately people are going to lose their law licenses. I think there's going to be a real microscope into the judicial system and how this took place, where approvals were given for these type of settlements without them being on court record, without there being a court order approving these settlements. I think it's going to be a top to bottom look. And I really do think that at the end of the day, there's going to be a cleanup that happens, because this is really an indictment on the South Carolina justice system. We don't like the way we're looking to the rest of the world and the nation. It's not who we are. And I really do believe that our Chief Justice and a lot of the people in the justice system are going to be looking at this. And it's this particular case that is going to cause a lot of people to have to take pause. You know, when you're talking about $4 million being misdirected, it's being done by mail, it's being done by wire, it's being done through different banks, which implicates all kinds of money laundering, conspiracy to commit fraud, all those type of economic business crimes that carry with it extensive penalties. The thing that I learned today that really shocked me is that Mr. Murdoch set up a dummy company and a dummy bank account where the money that was sent from Corey Fleming after he took his attorney's fees went to a company called Forge. Believe it or not, Forge. That's the name that Mr. Murdoch chose to have the money deposited in. And he took that check and deposited it in an account. And he took that money allegedly for himself. The reason he used the word forge is we have a company in Georgia called Forge Consulting, which does structured settlements for large settlements. And that is, if you get a $1 million settlement, you don't want the money to go all at one time to a minor. You can structure it to be paid out over a number of years, and you purchase an annuity so that over a course of 15, 20 years, that $1 million can be worth $3 million. And so it's allegedly Mr. Murdoch had Corey Fleming make that check payable to Forge, the remaining amount of that almost $4 million that was recovered. And then he took the rest, or that's what we are told.
So Eric, that is a massive allegation. So let's just sort that out for a second. First of all, are you working with the police with regard to this? Because by my estimation, and, you know, in conference with very smart lawyers, that is mail fraud, wire fraud, theft of trust of monies, which is all extraordinarily serious. Are you working with the police on all of this with regard to what Alex Murdoch could be exposed to?
No, I'm working with the lawyers who are representing parties. And Ashley, there are a lot of lawyers who know what happened in this case in that town. And a lot of people are contributing information. It is a fact that the check, according to Mr. Fleming, was made out to Forge, was sent to a P.O. box. That money should have been sent to the personal representative, because that personal representative has an obligation to the court to marshal all the funds, account for them, and then distribute them according with the court order and according with the intestate law of South Carolina. It seems that Mr. Fleming bypassed the personal representative and sent the check directly to Mr. Murdoch. It should have gone to Mr. Westendorf, where Mr. Westendorf would have to report to the probate court how he distributed those funds, because they were both wrongful death funds and a thing called survival funds. Wrongful death, the money goes directly to the heirs because of the death of Gloria Satterfield. And then $25,000 of that $505,000 is a survival claim because she survived for 3 weeks. And that has to go through the probate court. That was not done here. So initially, when we thought it was just a $505,000 piece of litigation, we quickly learned that that was an excess policy settlement, an umbrella policy settlement. But there were more than $3 million of other insurance policies that were settled that Mr. Fleming took his fee. He made sure he took his legal fee, all the duties that he has to the client to pay the money, the net money to them. He made sure he got his legal fees, and then he gave the rest of the money to some P.O. box and wrote a check to Forge. And he knows that Forge is not Forge Consulting, because, Ashley, when you do structured settlements, there's a whole host of paperwork that has to be filled out, a whole host of agreements that have to be signed, settlement agreements. And you actually have to get the permission of the beneficiaries that they're willing to take their money over time, as opposed to get a lump sum check.
So, Eric, are you saying that net the attorney's fees, which, as I recall, were somewhere around $177,000, the
$3 million plus?
So, go ahead.
Yes. A third of $3 million plus. So Mr. Fleming got paid at least a third of what totally was recovered, which we believe is $4 million, Ashley.
So over $1 million in attorney's fees, and then you're saying the remaining $3 million went into this Forge dummy company, and you know about it, and you're suing to get it back. Does it still even exist?
I'm told that Mr. Murdoch has gone through all his money. You know, Mr. Harpootlian got up in court over the past couple of days and, you know, came up with the smokescreen defense that he has this 20-year opioid addiction. How is somebody gooped up on opioid and trying cases, acting in front of juries and coming in court? It's impossible that you can spend those millions of dollars just taking street level opioids. It's a defense. I get it that Mr. Harpootlian has to come up with a defense, but he better go back to the drawing board, because that one's not going to hold water.
Okay, so Eric, hold with me. I want to just fit in a quick break, but when we come back, I do want to ask you some very important questions about Tony and Brian. That's Gloria Satterfield's sons, who were due the money and got nothing, because I've read some things about their life that, you know, at one point their mom was homeless, that the funeral wasn't even supported by the Murdochs, that life had been very difficult for them. So I want to get an update on how they're doing. And then I also want to ask you some questions we discovered today in the probate court about Paul. There's a whole estate opened up for him in probate, but nothing for Maggie. I want to ask about the significance right after this break. We're breaking some news tonight with some explosive allegations in the, wait for it, Murdoch saga, specifically the 2018 death of Murdoch's housekeeper and the insurance money, upwards of maybe $4 million of it, that no one seems quite able to account for, except for Eric Bland, who just now has said, pretty heavy allegation there, Eric, that you believe that millions of that settlement went to a dummy company called Forge, and definitely not to your clients. Can I ask you about your clients? Because the reporting on Gloria is that 25 years she worked for the Murdochs, that she was homeless for a lot of it, really had money problems, and that the funeral wasn't paid for by the Murdochs. How are the boys? What's their circumstance?
They're salt of the earth kids. One's in the late 20s, others in their young 30s. They're not wealthy by any means at all. Hardworking kids. They're betrayed. They feel betrayed. They're scared. They're shocked. Obviously, now that they heard that there's a possible criminal investigation in the death of their mother. You know, it was traumatic to lose your mother at that age when she was 57. But, you know, they've been dealing with a whole host of emotions over the past 2 weeks, realizing that they've been betrayed by a family that they had tremendous respect for. It took a tremendous amount of courage to go hire a lawyer, consult with lawyers to possibly bring these type of allegations against the Murdoch, Mr. Murdoch and his family's name. And then to find out that these people that you trusted for so long, possibly the state is looking into, had a hand in the death of your mother in a way that was not accidental. That is scary.
Eric, I have two more questions for you in very little time, and I want to cover them. The first is that there is so much chatter and even, you know, allegations made to police after the boating accident that the Murdochs get away with everything. One of them is that this was said by one of the kids in the boat that that Paul pushed her down the stairs. That's a huge allegation. But is there anything to it that you know of now as you dig into this case?
I do not. I take, you know, Alex at his word that he said his dogs tripped Gloria down the stairs. So until I see contrary evidence of that, we have to take him at his word. However, his credibility at this point is extremely bad. We know that because of all the
different lines. That's fair. Yeah, the whole shot in the head part, but he looks great. Then this last part, and I only have about 30 seconds, but I really do want to know about this. We checked the court records, and it turns out that an estate's been opened up in probate court for Paul Murdoch, but not Maggie. They both died on the very same day in the very same way. It seems odd that there wouldn't be an estate opened up for both of them. Do you see anything? Do you read anything into that?
Not necessarily. They have time to open it up, but one may have had a will and the other did not. Maggie probably did have a will and a trust, and Paul has died intestate without a will because he was so young. So it does make sense that he may have opened up an estate, but it wouldn't surprise me that Maggie will open up an estate through some other personal representative. Now, if she didn't die, believe it or not, her husband is entitled to 50% of her assets as well as her surviving child, Buster. So
I will say, I will say there was an application for what's called a renunciation of appointment, meaning Alex did not want to be the natural representative for Paul, and instead that was handed over to Randy. I am right out of time, but will you join me again next week? This has just been so enlightening. I so appreciate your time. Thank you, Eric Bland.
People are going to start to talk if I keep joining your show, Ashley.
I have to keep saying allegedly, because it's just a sort of astounding all the things that you're telling me each night. Eric, have a good weekend, and thank you for this.
Take care.
Still ahead, a little bit more on the law enforcement theme, policing in America, with two of my favorite sheriffs and a roundup of the life and death moments that no cop ever wants to face. That's next. It is the weekend, and that means our weekly look at policing in America. Joining me tonight are Sheriff Mark Lamb of Pinal County, Arizona, and the host of the American Sheriff Network. And from Volusia County, Florida, Sheriff Mike Cheatwood. It's good to see both of you. Thank you both for joining me on this Friday night. Let's just dive right in, shall we? Going to start with some body cam video that's been released from a very difficult situation. It happened in Houston. Two members of the gang task force attempt to make a traffic stop. You know those. They're sometimes the worst things that a police officer does. This one involving a suspect, but he flees and then leads them on a chase that ends when he crashes into a concrete pillar under the freeway, and that is where we pick up the body cam video. Let's take a look.
We're doing the peak right up at Monroe 45. Right up at Monroe 45. Good work.
Let me see your head! Let me see your head!
We got one at gunpoint.
Let me see your head! Hey! Hands! 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 Hands!
Underneath 45 in Monroe. 45 Monroe.
Let me see your head! Hands! Stop reaching! Stop reaching! Stop reaching! Hey, watch the crossfire! Stop reaching! Hey, let me see your hands! 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 Keep him up! Keep him up! Keep him reaching! He's reaching! Hey, hands! He's reaching!
Oh, man. The stress, the panic, the fear. Sheriff Lamb, I'll bet you know exactly what that police officer was feeling as he was trying to compel that suspect to show his hands. Tell me why it is so important that they see the suspect's hands at all times.
Yeah, if we can't see their hands, Ashley, then we don't know what they're doing. That is the most dangerous thing. I've went through a training called Force Science, which tells you how quickly people can pull a gun from areas if you can't see their hands. They gave this man so many good commands. They were very clear. He knew who they were, and yet he continued to not comply. And in the end, he forced these officers to take his life. It's tragic to see, but I'm glad that they get to go home tonight.
Let me ask the control room to pull that banner back, and there you go. That's what's on the floor of the car. It was indeed a gun that they found on the floor. So, Sheriff Chitwood, the suspect did put his hands up and then put them down and then up and then down. And the police officers who were responding were trying to see all this through all that shattered glass. It's probably like the worst combination of circumstances. And then just the fear that, A, you might get shot if you're the officer. B, you may now go to prison if you're the officer. How do you deal with that metric in that situation?
Yeah, Ashley, great questions. And there's so much unknown. Who is this guy? Did they know who he was? They have warrants out for his arrest. But Sheriff Lamb is exactly right. The only thing that can hurt us are these. We can look, your eyes can't hurt us, but your hands can. And when we can't see them and you're diving around and you're giving commands, Officer Salazar, having the presence and awareness to even say, be aware of the crossfire, he knew instinctively that something was not right, and he gave the command to his partner, watch the crossfire, was this isn't going to end well. And I commend these officers for what they did. Thank God for body camera footage, because God knows how this would have been played out if it wasn't for the body camera.
Yeah, that 32-year-old man, you could see him reaching over to the driver's wheel well several times, and that's where that gun was found. He died in that incident, and that is just so upsetting just to see it all play out like that. Hey, guys, hold on to your seats for a second, because when we come back, I'm going to ask you that question about, oh, dear, what happens when someone gets a hold of your gun? I would feel like it's about the worst thing that can happen to you, both because it's frustrating, you never want to lose it, but then also the danger. And there was an incident that played out like that. I'm going to ask you about it right after the break. Stay with us. Policing in America continues with the guys from Live PD. We're back at taking a look at what life behind the badge is like with Sheriff Mark Lamb, host of the American Sheriff Network, and Sheriff Mike Chitwood. Guys, thank you again for standing by. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm thinking about the worst feeling for any officer has to be if a suspect gets control of his or her weapon. And that is what happened in Houston. So I'm going to take you there. Officers were responding to a woman's call. She said the suspect had choked her. Officers entered the apartment, and that's where we pick up the body cam. I do want to warn some of our viewers here, this could be disturbing to see. Wow, Sheriff Lamb, that is terrifying. They, you know, that suspect got the gun of one of the officers and the partner had to shoot him. And that's a fatal shot. I mean, he didn't survive that. I assume that you guys have each other's six at all times, no matter where you are, whether you're in front or back.
Oh, absolutely. And you can see just by this video how hard it is to even determine what's going on. It's not a lot different when you're out there on scene either. There's a lot of hands moving, arms flailing, a lot going on. For the other guy to see that his partner lost his gun shows how in control of this scene they still were, even though it looks chaotic. And in the end, he had to make a split-second decision, not only to save his life, but his partner's life and everybody else in that house. These are always tragic, but once again, we see guys that are doing a great job. Clearly, they've been trained well, and we don't, like the sheriff said earlier, we don't know all the circumstances to this case, but from what I can see and what their reaction and how they handled this situation, once that officer lost control of his gun, you know, this is about the best outcome you can hope for.
It just happens so fast, right? I'm on the phone and then bang, you know, he's got the gun. It's just so scary how quickly it all can turn. All right, zipping up to upstate New York real quickly, a few miles from Niagara Falls. Officers showed how quickly they think on their toes, and I literally mean that because they had to stand on their toes and channel their firefighting brothers using their cruiser to actually rescue a family from a burning home. Take a peek.
The wall. 10-4.
Right here.
You guys are the only three left?
There's four of them.
Where's the fire?
How do you get up top? How do you get up top?
So, Sheriff Chitwood, what I love here is that the cops are the first on the scene, as is often the case, which is surprising, I think, to a lot of people. They pulled their cruiser up to the car, up to the house, and stood on the car and rescued the people on the second floor in that way. And I'll bet you're going to tell me that that is not unusual, Mike, is it?
Not at all, Ashley. You know, I wish we, America, would see more of these videos. The bravery and the heroism of our men and women in law enforcement is only equaled by those in the military. I mean, we're there to save lives. It's not about getting in shootings and car stops and everything else. It's these things that happen every single day. CPR, you know, saving drowning victims. This is a perfect incident of what do I have available to save lives? God bless these officers, and thank God this family's alive because of quick-thinking police work.
Yep, four people and their dog safely rescued. Too much smoke for them to be able to get down the stairs or for the officers to be able to get up the stairs. So that's why we have this great body cam. Hey, Sheriff Mark Lamb and Sheriff Mike Chitwood, it is great to see you. Please be safe out there this weekend so we can see you again next week and all the weeks after, guys.
Thanks, Ashley.
Thank you, Ashley. God bless you, and God bless your audience.
All right. Take care, everyone, and thanks for watching Banfield tonight and all week long. Have a great weekend. We'll see you Monday.